Hi, my name is Chris Brennan, and you're listening to the Astrology Podcast. This episode is recorded on Tuesday, March 21st, 2017, starting just after 2:16 p.m. in Denver, Colorado, and this is the 101st episode of the show. For more information about how to subscribe to the podcast and help support the production of future episodes by becoming a patron, please visit theastrologypodcast.com/subscribe. In this episode, I'm going to be talking with astrologer Kenneth Miller about the age of Aquarius. Kenneth, welcome back to the show.
Pleasure to be back, Chris. Thank you for having me.
It's been a long time. I think the last time we talked was, a year ago? We did a couple episodes. First, the tropical versus sidereal zodiacs, or second, and then the one on the Star of Bethlehem, right?
Actually, we did the famous versus non-famous charts debate real early on. I don't know. I've been here a few times. It's always a pleasure. We always have fun. If people like this, look up our previous shows together. But yeah, Star of the Bethlehem was the last one we did, which was a year ago last December.
Yeah, and that was a lot of fun. And then the sidereal versus tropical zodiac one, of course, will be very relevant to our discussion today.
Yeah.
Let's see. So before we get started, let's see, just a few announcements to get out of the way about the giveaway that we're doing for patrons of the show at the end of the month. So each month we give away prizes for patrons who donate money in order to support the production of the show. And this month we're giving away two prizes. The first one is a pass to the upcoming retreat that's being hosted by the Organization for Professional Astrology. And then the second is a signed copy of my new book, Hellenistic Astrology, The Study of Fate and Fortune.
Wow. So,
yeah, those are awesome prizes, I think. You got your copy of the book a few weeks ago, right?
Yes, I did. As soon as I saw it was available.
You sent in a picture, which I really appreciate. You found a local street, I think.
Yes, I found a... For those of you that don't know, Chris is recording this in Denver, and I found Denver Street here in San Diego and took my picture with his book underneath it. But a fantastic book, and so far and above, the best book, and maybe the only book really on in-depth Hellenistic astrology. It's just great. I love the way it's organized, and I'm not here to give a book review, but check it out, people.
Sure. So let's see. So we're giving away a copy of that, and we're giving away a copy or a free pass to the Oprah retreat. So very quickly about the Oprah retreat, it's taking place October 19th through the 22nd of 2017. It's at Zion National Park, which is in Utah. Oprah has a unique peer group format where they have several different tracks, and you choose from one of these tracks, and each track is led by a specific OPA qualified track coordinator. And each of these tracks has a maximum of 10 participants. So what you have is a really intimate group that focuses on the same topic for an intensive for 3 days with the same mentor. So in addition to the tracks, everybody comes together at different points throughout the weekend for some short lectures. The theme of the retreat is the art of living and dying, and they're going to have some lectures on Jupiter's ingress into Scorpio, as well as some other lectures on astronomy for astrologers. So because each track has a maximum of 10 people, five of the tracks are already sold out of 13 tracks. So if you're interested in finding out more information or signing up, you can go to opaastrology.org. And in terms of the other prize, my book, it's 700 pages, covers the history, philosophy, and techniques of ancient astrology, has 120 example charts, 60 diagrams, teaches you some techniques that can enhance techniques that modern astrologers already use today, as well as other techniques that were lost in the transmission of astrology over the past 2,000 years. So I'm actually going to send out two signed copies, which I'm sending out via priority mail, so you get them within 2 days. For winners of the drawing later this month. For those of you who don't win the drawing, you can always just order a copy of the book at hellenisticastrology.com/book. And for US orders, I can send out a signed copy to you via 2-day mail. All right, so that's the drawing this month. Pretty good prizes, but let's jump right into our topic this month, which is the Age of Aquarius. And this is actually a show that you and I have been talking about doing for, I feel like, a couple years now, at least, right?
Yes.
Yeah, it's been on my list forever because it's one of those huge topics in astrology because it's one of the few astrological topics that has sort of like general currency in the broader sort of community in the world at large, where it's like most people have heard about this what's, you know, supposedly like a quasi-astrological concept, even if you're not an astrologer or you don't otherwise know anything about astrology, you've probably heard about this idea of the age of Aquarius, right?
Exactly. And if you've heard of it, you've heard, you know, if you haven't heard the fifth dimension song, this is the age of Aquarius. And if you've been living on Earth for a while, you might be looking around going, really, this is the age of Aquarius? So hopefully we can unpack what that all means and where the concept came from and different ways of identifying what, quote, the age of Aquarius is.
Yeah. So I want to break this down and sort of explore the whole topic, but sort of start from square one. And I mean, one thing that we should both say, so both of us are graduates of Kepler, of the Kepler degree program, when it still had a degree program, between the year, I guess, 2000 and 2010.
The golden age of academic astrology in the United States. Yes.
Right. The figurative age of astrology, of astrological education. And one of our, you know, our teachers, our core teachers in that program was Nick Campion. And this is the age of Aquarius, and studies surrounding the age of Aquarius as like a social phenomenon, has been like one of his, almost like his hobby horses, but I almost don't want to use that term because it sounds like I'm downplaying it or denigrating or something. But this has really been something he's focused a lot of research on and written a number of papers and book chapters and other things about, right?
Correct. And actually, in preparation for this, our session today, I pulled out my copy of Astrology, History, and Apocalypse, where he has a whole section on the age of Aquarius. And there's numerous other things he's, you know, written as well.
Yeah. So I wanted to mention that at the top, because we're going to be drawing heavily on his work for this. But you can pretty much check out any of Nick's books, and he'll have some coverage of this topic, either in terms of the history and origins of it, or in terms of how astrologers conceptualize it, or how astrologers have debated the different ways that it's defined. I recently got, they recently released a paperback version of his book, Astrology and Popular Religion in the Modern West, by Nicholas Campion. I think just in the past year, it came out as a paperback. And I think this is like a shortened version of his dissertation, which was published a few years ago. But he covers a lot of stuff related to this topic in there as well. So I'd really recommend it. In addition to the book you mentioned, Astrology, History, and Apocalypse, which is actually one of the first books that really got me interested in and inspired me to really want to study the history of astrology more closely, because it showed me how important it was in terms of understanding where everything comes from, especially if you're using these techniques.
Right.
All right. So let's start from square one. I mean, the broadest statement, what we're going to be talking about here is a theory in the astrological community called the theory of the astrological ages. And roughly speaking, what this theory entails is the idea that there are roughly these 2,000-year periods of history that are ruled by each of the zodiacal signs. And the idea is that we've been in one, which is the age or the sign of Pisces, for the past 2,000 years approximately, and that in theory, another 2,000-year period associated with Aquarius is supposed to be starting soon, or has already started, or is starting now, or is sort of eminently starting sometime in the not too distant future. Right? That broadly speaking, that's the most broad statement you could make about this topic.
Yes. And now okay. We have to say, now we have to get into the astronomy of why that is the case. But yeah.
Right. So this is an idea that it actually is surprisingly recent. This idea didn't become popular until the 19th century. And that sort of in and of itself is a really important point, because oftentimes I think in discussions within the astrological community about this concept, it's assumed that it's much older than it actually is, or oftentimes people will try to find evidence that it's been used for, you know, hundreds or thousands of years. But in one of the things that Campion really emphasizes in his studies of this is that as an idea or a phenomenon, it really only seems to trace back to about the late 19th century or mid-19th century or so.
I'm going
to
say there's three phases. And by the way, everyone, we're being very general, and we're going to be taking some, you know, liberties with detail to make some generalizations so we can get through the session here. But I am going to postulate that there's basically three phases to this. the first phase is the notion of the Platonic year, which I'll get into in a second, which Campion thinks is kind of the progenitor of all this thinking. And then you get the 19th century notion of we're on the precipice of a new age. I'm not talking about the new age movement of now, but this notion of humanity is about to undergo a transformation and it's going to be better and a better place for everyone. And a new age is coming. And then the third step is the third development of that idea is that there are astrological ages that we can apply to history. And the age of Aquarius is actually this coming new age. So how does that sound to you, Chris? I'm painting with a broad brush, but.
No, I think that's good. What was this? The second one was just identifying precession in general.
Yeah, not precession in general, but just the notion of a coming new age. This is where we get into. Okay. Well, let's go back to let's start from the beginning, which would be this notion of the Platonic year, which is this idea that, the universe itself would cease to exist when all the planets, conjuncted in either, Cancer or Capricorn. Now, this idea goes back to Berosus, but the notion that this would happen periodically and a kind of symbolic number was given to it of like 36,000 years, so that approximately every 36,000 years, all the mechanisms of the heavens would line up and everything would come together, and it would herald the end of the old and the beginning of the new. And this got the name, quote, a Platonic year.
Right, or the great year.
Or the great year, yes.
But this is a concept that Plato mentions, but he doesn't actually give a number to it.
No.
And he doesn't say where, he just makes some general statement, I think, in the Timaeus, about all of the planets returning to where they started, when the cosmos originated or something like that, right?
Right. And, Berosus is an ancient figure that is at the dawn of horoscopic astrology. He's representing the Mesopotamian tradition. He sets up a school in Kos. We don't know exactly what he taught, and only fragments of his writing survived. And much of that is on this kind of mundane topic of, these cataclysms. But he felt that when all the planets lined up in Cancer, the world would be, purged by fire. Why fire? Well, because in the Northern Hemisphere, it's summer and it's like the hottest time during that. And then he thought it would be, cleansed by water when everything lined up in Capricorn. But he, so that fragments of him talking about that did survive and do survive to this day. And you can look that up.
Sure. So you have Plato, mentioning this idea of a great year of all the planets coming back to where they started, in whatever the 4th century BCE. And then a couple centuries later, you have Berosus, and he's a Mesopotamian astrologer who had a reputation for importing astrology from Mesopotamia and then setting up a school for astrologers, and starting to teach, Greeks astrology. And then he had a more specific version of this where he's talking about, the planets all aligning in Cancer, Capricorn. And then you jump forward to the next like large sort of idea or astrological idea connected with that would be the Jupiter Saturn cycles, right?
Yes. And of course, this, played a major role in, Persian, political or mundane astrology, and plays a big role in contemporary Indian astrology, and plays a role in Western mundane, depending on what flavor of mundane you do. But this notion of, the cycles of the conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn. But actually, there is one other missing piece, which I want to mention, and that is the rise of Christianity. And the rise of this notion that there is a discrete place in history where there's going to be a second coming and a kingdom of heaven established on earth. Because that Campion calls this millennial kind of thinking, not millennial as in if you're a young person, you're a millennial, but the notion that, the year 1000 seemed like, well, this is a significant year. This must be the year that Jesus is coming back and everything's going to be transformed and the earth's going to be a new Eden. And there was some of that you know, when the year 2000 rolled around. So it's kind of deep in the Western psyche that there's going to be a moment where everything changes, and we tend to attach that to certain specific cycles.
Right. And it got attached in the Christian tradition and in Western culture with thousand-year increments because, and this is where we get the idea of millenarianism, which is that in Christianity, it's defined, like I just did a search for millenarianism, and Google's defining it as the doctrine of or belief in a future and typically imminent thousand-year age of blessedness beginning with or culminating in the second coming of Christ. So it's this idea that there's going to be a thousand-year age of, like, you know, peace and enlightenment or what have you, however that's conceptualized originally in a Christian context, but then later other philosophies and religions started to adopt it a little bit as well. So, yeah, and astrologically, that then eventually got tied in the medieval tradition with, you know, the Jupiter-Saturn cycles, which traditionally were the furthest outer planets and the slowest outer planets. Those conjunctions take place every 20 years. But then somebody in the medieval or Persian tradition noticed that they would always take place in the same triplicities, so in signs of the same element that are trined to each other. Right. And that takes place for what, approximately like 200 or 260 years or something like that, that it'll take place, the conjunctions will happen in the same triplicities.
Right.
Right. So, for example, for the past 200 years, all of the Jupiter Saturn conjunctions have taken place in air signs in the tropical zodiac. And then eventually that switches to, it sort of moves a few degrees each time, and eventually it'll switch into another, triplicity. So eventually it'll go through all four triplicities, earth, air, fire, and water, in approximately 960 years, which is almost 1,000 years. So then in the medieval period, this like thousand year shift started getting lined up with or associated with the births of religions and things like that in some of the medieval literature. So this became a long-term predictive astrological technique that got associated with some predictive doctrines as well, or some religious doctrine.
Right.
So fast forward then? I mean, does that then take us essentially?
Yeah, then I would fast forward us to like Theosophy, Madame Blavatsky writing The Secret Doctrine, and this notion that there's a coming, you know, coming new age or a coming new golden age, and this notion that not only do I think it, Theosophy was a religious and philosophical movement, which is still alive today, by the way, but it was started in the last quarter of the 19th century. And the byline of Theosophy is there's no religion higher than truth. So it was all about like seeking truth and the truth of different individual religious paths. And there was this notion that we were on the precipice of this new age. And so Theosophical writers would write about that. And it was also a feeling, somewhat of a feeling in Western culture in general. I mean, things were being invented. It just seemed like science was was on the precipice of answering every possible question. And, you know, there was, you had these, like the world fairs of like the 1890s, and just this feeling of optimism, like, wow, you know, electricity's coming. Like everything is just about to change.
Sure. And so there was this real undercurrent starting in the mid 19th century. So the mid 1800s of like the birth of what we would associate today with the New Age movement, which is this almost a countercultural movement. It started with spiritualism, but then out of that grew Theosophy, or what's called the Theosophical Society. And they thought that we were at the precipice of like a huge shift in the world and in society and culture and world history, where everyone was about to become enlightened, both spiritually enlightened and in other ways. And one of the things that was also happening at that time is you had ideas surrounding like Darwin's theories of evolution became more widely sort of promoted and accepted. And some of that got imported into discussions about religious matters, so that Madame Blavatsky, one of the people who, the person who founded the Theosophical Society, which is like the start of the New Age movement, she incorporated ideas of you know, physical, biological evolution and applied it to spiritual growth, and said that people grow spiritually through karma and reincarnation and things like that by incorporating Eastern teachings of karma and reincarnation.
But adding this layer of kind of spiritual evolution, and this is important. Actually, this is an important aside for your listeners. The concept of evolution has become so embedded in our worldview that we think of nothing. In fact, I even saw Nick Campion in the Astrology, History, and Apocalypse makes this mistake where he's reading some medieval text and he's using the word they're talking about spiritual evolution. No, that concept didn't exist then. You know, when you, the notion that you had to, quote, evolve to get better, you know, the ancient notion was more, there was this inner perfection that you just had to realize, you know, kind of a more, we see this more in like Buddhist thought, but it was around in alchemical thought in the Middle Ages and through the alchemy period, this notion that if you just purified something enough, it became perfect. It wasn't that you had to slog through all this evolution. But that's something that has just become so ingrained in us because we learned that concept from such a young age. And she definitely applied it to, you know, spiritual evolution. There was a whole, you know, that to me, she was like ground zero for this notion of, quote, spiritual evolution. And you had to slog through all this stuff to, quote, evolve spiritually. And, you know, maybe it's, I'm not saying whether it's true or not. I'm just saying that concept, when you hear people talk about history, be careful because no one really thought about things in an evolutionary way until post-Darwin.
Right. Yeah. Just in terms of tracing the history of ideas and tracing back the origins of some of these concepts, or at least when they become popularized. So that's important because one of the points that Campion emphasizes that I always thought was really interesting and has continued to be relevant to me as I've gotten older and just viewed how things happen and different social movements is he makes this point, and I have no idea where he made it. He's probably made it a few different times, but that there's always this tendency where groups, or sometimes individuals will either, idealize this distant golden age in the past. So they'll look back into the past and like idealize, you know, when things were better back then, when people were, you know, wiser or enlightened or some kind of, you know, idealized version of the past, and that somehow things have devolved since then and gotten to this low point where everything is, you know, decrepit and has fallen apart and is not as good as it used to be. So either they'll do that, or they'll do the opposite, which is to idealize some future golden age that's like right around the corner, and that we're right on the brink of, or that it's sometime coming up in the future, and that somehow the present again is kind of downplayed or is kind of made to look worse, or not worse, but made to look bad in some way, and it's put up against this idealized golden age in the future.
Watch an episode of The Jetsons.
Sure. Right, The Jetsons, or I mean, even to some extent, like looking at, you know, traditional astrology, that's sometimes one of the narratives that happens is like, you know, and it's ironic for me to be talking about this in the context of just releasing my book, but it's a point that I actually do bring up both in the introduction and the conclusion of the book, which is, you know, it's very easy to lapse into that. And you sometimes see astrologers go through phases with that, where they'll get fed up with modern astrology, or they'll discover older forms of astrology, and they'll start idealizing them and say everything was great about the ancients and everything we're doing today is terrible, or something like that.
Right. Right.
I always try to be careful because on the one hand, I think there's something valuable to be gained about studying older traditions of astrology, and I think they're great. But I always try to moderate that tendency to go too far with that and say, you know, only the old ways are the good ways and the current ways are all terrible, to sort of be careful, you know, that students don't go too far in that direction, because it leads to this sort of imbalance where it's not really true, and it can lead to some problems. So, anyways, that's probably one of the core things, though, underlying this, is that at some point in the late 19th century, through the Theosophical Society and through Madame Blavatsky, a bunch of these different ideas came together. And one of the big ones was the idea that there's this golden age that's right around the corner. And one of the things that was happening at the time is that some texts, some ancient like astronomical and astrological texts, were being dated using the phenomenon of precession, which is the gradual movement of the, you could frame it in different ways, but either of the equinoxes and the solstices moving and sort of drifting gradually against the backdrop of the fixed stars and the constellations. Or another way you could phrase precession is that it's the gradual drift of the tropical zodiac moving about out of alignment with the sidereal zodiac about 1 degree every 72 years, approximately.
Thank you so much, Chris, for describing it from both sides, because so many times I find that tropical astrologers are so locked in to the notion that the planets are the one, or that the stars are the ones drifting. And yet from the sidereal perspective, it's the Earth that's acting weird. And in fact, astronomically, it is the Earth acting weird and wobbling around. Anyway, but yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's important just because it's all relative and it's just a matter of what perspective you're looking at it from. Right. But the general point is just that, so precession's been known about for over 2000 years now. It was discovered by Hipparchus, sometime around the second century BCE.
And let me just jump on my soapbox again, not to interrupt you, Chris, but this is the thing, you know, it drives me crazy. Every few years, some so-called scientists will make a news report that, oh, those astrologers don't know what they're doing. The stars aren't lining up with the signs. That was a decision that Western astrology made at the beginning of the tradition. You know, people noticed that something weird was going on and there was some drift. You know, they didn't know if it was a one-way ticket, which we now know, or whether it was some kind of multi-degree wobbling around. But the fact is that the first day of spring, the stars were moving a little bit, and that was noticed. And the decision was made to anchor the tropical zodiac or the Western zodiac to the seasons. That wasn't a mistake. That was a decision made, you know, whereas, say, the Indian tradition, who had been a star-watching culture for a long time, they decided to, like, keep their eyes on the stars and divvy up the heavens by 12 that way. But the reason why this is an issue is that the dawn of horoscopic astrology, they were kind of lined up, and so it didn't really matter. The first day of spring, the beginning of Aries, was also rising when the sun rose. Okay, right. Sorry, off the soapbox.
No, that's really relevant because it means that, you know, this whole topic of the age of Aquarius is the same, or it's connected to the same phenomenon or the same thing as that whole debate over both the tropical versus sidereal zodiac issue, but also this recurrent sort of myth that suddenly or recently the zodiacs have moved out of alignment and that astrologers don't know about it, which we've talked about a few times before on the show, which is like this persistent sort of idea that keeps getting promoted in skeptical and scientific circles, even though, you know, precession has been known about for over 2000 years now. Right. And astrologers are very aware of it and deliberately tend to adopt either the one zodiac or the other, either the tropical zodiac or the sidereal zodiac.
Right.
So this takes us back to the core of this as a technical concept, which is essentially the way that the astrological ages are defined is by the vernal point, which coincides with the first degree of Aries in the tropical zodiac. And it also coincides just in terms of the calendar with the first day of spring when the sun moves across this point. That's the first day of spring in the northern hemisphere. And that's part of the reason why it's used to define the start of the tropical zodiac using that reference system. So that point of the vernal point or 0 degrees Aries in the tropical zodiac moves. 2,000 years ago, that point was lined up with 0 degrees of Aries in the sidereal zodiac, which is connected with the constellations, whereas 0 degrees of Aries in the tropical zodiac is aligned with the seasons. So roughly 2,000 years ago, those were aligned, but then over the past 2,000 years, they've slowly shifted about 1 degree every 72 years. So that at this point, they're about, what, like 23, 24 degrees off?
Yeah, about 24 and some change, I think, now, depending on where you want to start the sidereal zodiac. So let me just clarify what Chris said. We have, there's actually three zodiacs, you might say. There's the tropical zodiac, which takes the first day of spring and divides the year into 12 equal segments. First day of spring is always the beginning of Aries. And as Chris said, 2,000 years ago, the first star, you know, the constellation Aries was basically rising on that first day of spring. So they were in alignment. What sidereal astrologers do is they take the stars and divide the sky into 12 equal sections based not on the first day of spring, but where they believe the beginning of the constellation Aries is, but divide the sky equally in 12. That's a similar feature to the tropical and the sidereal zodiac. They divide things equally by 12. The third zodiac is the actual constellations that are of various sizes. Aries is super teeny. Virgo is giant. They overlap each other. And astrologers tend to not deal with this because the astrological tradition has always been about dividing a circle into equal 12 segments. But this also makes the age of Aquarius a little sticky, as we'll get into later, because Aquarius as a constellation overlaps Pisces, but we'll get to that in a little bit, I'm sure.
Yeah, we'll get to that one. So essentially right now, 0 degrees, where 0 degrees of Aries is in the tropical zodiac, if you had a planet there, then it would be at like what degree in the sidereal zodiac?
Yeah, it would be like 5, 6 degrees, you know, it backs up. So in other words, in fact, let me just calculate a chart for today. So for example, today we know that the sun is in tropical, Aries at about in the second degree.
Oh, right. So we just had actually the sun.
Because we just had the equinox, a little while ago, and, the sun is in very early Aries. But if I recast the chart into the sidereal zodiac, that's going to back things up because the seasons of the earth have become unaligned from the stars. And so the sun is in the 8th degree of Pisces. Okay. Right now. That's why the period we're living in is called the Piscean Age, because the stars, the first day of spring, shortly after, no, I don't want to necessarily pin it to Christ's birth, but, you know, early in the Christian tradition, it was the stars of Pisces that were rising on the first day of spring. And over time, every year, it backs up a little bit, backs up a little bit. As Chris said, it's like 72 years per degree. And so, eventually, we will get to the point where on the first day of spring, the sidereal sign, the star sign of Aquarius will be rising with the sun on the first day of spring. And that is one of the ways you can define the age of Aquarius. But did I get ahead of ourselves?
No, that's okay. Good. The point is just that it's moving backwards that 2,000 years ago, at some point, the vernal point, so 0 degrees of Aries in the tropical zodiac, was aligned with 0 degrees of Aries in the sidereal zodiac. But then because the vernal point moves backwards through the sidereal signs, essentially 1 degree every 72 years, eventually the vernal point moved into 29 degrees of Pisces in the sidereal zodiac. And then it went 1 degree every 72 years over the past, 2,000 years. So that now, depending on what calculations you use for the sidereal zodiac, the vernal point is somewhere in the early degrees of Pisces. So you said it was at what, like 6 degrees using your Ionomtia?
Seven. It's in the 8th degree, give or take a few minutes, depending on where you want to place the beginning of Aries. But,
okay. So it's at 8 degrees of Pisces. And then eventually, continually moving it
back
1 degree every 72 years, eventually it'll move to the very beginning of Pisces. And then eventually it'll slip into Aquarius.
Right.
And at that point, at least, you know, according to this concept, just defined very generally,
right,
that's when the theoretical age of Aquarius would begin, whenever the vernal point moves into sidereal Aquarius.
Now, I've taken the liberty of calculating, using current astrological software, the beginning of the age of Aquarius as defined in the way we're talking about. We're going to get into in a little bit other ways of thinking about the age of Aquarius. But well, in terms of this notion of...
Maybe you should explain the Ayanamsha, or just the concept of the Ayanamsha.
Yeah, so the Ayanamsha is a Indian word, and it simply means it's the measurement between the first day of spring and the beginning of the sidereal sign of Aries. And because there is no particularly bright star to mark the beginning of that constellation, there is some debate over exactly where that starts. So if you go back 100 years in India, it was frequently defined as being so much distance beyond Zeta Pisces, which is the last star in the constellation of Pisces. And most of the Ayanamshas were kind of based on that concept. When India became a country, it became important to sort of unify the calendar of all the different states so that everyone was like celebrating holidays on the same day. So they had a calendar committee composed of scientists using kind of 1950s technology, and they came up with using the concept of using the star Spica as kind of the midway point of the sidereal zodiac, and then 100 degrees from that would mark the beginning of Aries, and they kind of lock that in. So the government of India uses that as the official start of the sidereal zodiac. Now, astrologers who have difficulty agreeing, no matter what culture you're in or what tradition,
one constant over the past several thousand years,
they will fudge with that a little bit, but most of them will be very close to that, to the what's called the Lahiri Ayanamsha, because Lahiri was the head of this calendar committee. Not to be confused with Yogananda's guru Lahiri, that was a common, or his guru's guru's Lahiri. There's Lahiri is kind of a common name in India, but so most of the Indian Ayanamshas in Indian astrology fall within minutes of that official one. So I calculate the actual start of the age of Aquarius as being on March 20th in 2467. And yes, grab your tissues because we have a ways to wait. At 6:38 Denver Mountain Time, assuming Denver's still maintaining that time. And that's probably plus or minus 50 years. So allowing for, we don't know exactly where the beginning is, but if Lahiri, you know, it was in the ballpark of the beginning of Aries, probably plus or take 50, 70 years. And it's likely to be like if there is any truth to these ages, it's likely to be like a tide coming in, not a light switch going on. It's not like, oh, age of Pisces, suddenly everything, like everyone wakes up the next day and it's everything's changed. It's more like a tide come, you know, one tide recedes and another tide comes in with its influence.
Sure.
But we want to just, yeah.
Just to be clear though, it all depends. So one of the issues with this concept just is like a technique, like the technique of the astrological ages is just that there's sometimes disagreement about where to start the first degree of the sidereal zodiac. And so depending on what starting point you use, it can be off by a few degrees, that there's a range of like a few degrees. Like if you use like some Western sidereal astrologers use like the Fagan Bradley Ayanamsha, which is like a few degrees off from.
Right. So Lahiri, basically you multiply 72. So, you know, Fagan Bradley would be off by, 210 years. Most of the Ayanamshas used by Indian astrologers are within a degree. So that would be plus or minus 72 years. There are some outliers out there, so that it does make it difficult to pin down exactly. But I guess I'm bringing up the notion of these tides because it doesn't, from that point of view, the exactness may not really matter because it's going to be something that gradually, you know, comes over the world. If we even want to buy into this notion that there are these astrological ages, because that concept itself is pretty new.
Sure. It's new. Let's finish defining it.
Okay. Yes.
We'll get into validity. Yeah, so yeah. Just one of the points, and this is one of the points that Campion makes, is that he surveyed the literature and he found not just dozens, but he found hundreds of different references to when the age of Aquarius would begin, because there's a million different ways of defining it, or there's a lot Correct. Of different ways you could define it, but also yes. because of this ambiguity, even about, what Ionomsha to use, there could be different starting points. And if, you know, because 1 degree, equals 72 years, even a small difference of a degree can sometimes throw the whole calculation off by like a century or so.
Yeah.
So that's one important thing, is that there's a huge span of yes. dates. Yes. There's different ways of defining it. And then I'm not sure if we should, maybe we should get to this point. There's also a more recent way of defining it, where in the 1970s, Robert Hand wrote this paper where he was actually drawing on the work of Carl Jung, who wrote a paper on this in the 1950s, who suggested that instead of using the sidereal zodiac, which is 12 signs of exactly 30 degrees each, measured relative to some specific starting point, like a fixed star or whatever you've used as your starting point, that instead you use the actual constellations and the fixed stars associated with the constellations themselves. But what they pointed out is that when you do this, the constellations of Pisces and Aquarius actually overlap a bit, so that you don't have this clean sort of, you know, one age ends and another age begins, but instead you have an overlap that lasts for like a few thousand years or something.
Right. And, you know, I was going to look that up and neglected to, I don't know if you did, to see, are we actually in that? I mean, how many degrees over does Aquarius stretch into Pisces? And are we, quote, in the age of Aquarius from that point of view already?
I think we will soon be,
if not.
I think what they said, if I remember correctly, is that we hit the first star of Pisces, or first star associated with Aquarius, would move past the vernal point around the 2060 or something like that.
Okay, so that's, wow. Put your tissues away. It's coming soon. And that will be, and I'll tell you when that's going to become a popular notion. I'm going to make a prediction now, not based on astrology, but based on human nature.
Right.
It's a little too soon, but very soon everyone in the Western world is going to be freaking out about 2040, because that's when Newton said the world was going to end. He did all these complex biblical calculations. Newton was a very interesting character, by the way. He didn't only spend his time doing science. And one of the things he did was study the Bible, unbelievable, and really was trying to find when the apocalypse was going to happen. And he predicted 2040. Now, once that passes, like all these things pass, and we survive that, then people will be like, oh, the first star of Aquarius is coming in 2060. So that will probably be like the next big thing that people are talking about, and will become, and people will be writing, well, whatever the equivalence is of books in that day, people will be writing about it.
Right. So we just got done with the 2012 thing a few years ago.
Right.
And then before that we had, you know, 1999 and 2000.
Yeah, the Y2K. We had the harmonic convergence. I mean, I've lived through quite a few of these.
Oh, yeah. I wasn't around for that, but I remember you mentioning that, the harmonic convergence. When was that again?
That was 1985, I believe. And I actually forget what the astronomical source of that was. But people like gathered in Sedona and different sacred spots and thought all kinds of things were going to happen.
I mean, if I remember correctly, it was just like some planets formed like a hexagon or something in the chart that was really close.
Yeah. I mean, I guess
if
I was motivated, I would do it, but it was another big thing. And this brings us up to, this isn't the only way to define age of Aquarius. There have been astrologers that have said that, or have argued that, Uranus ingressing or going into sidereal Aquarius, heralded the beginning of the age of Aquarius. Of course, that's going to happen with some regular period as Uranus travels around the zodiac. But that's actually mentioned. Someone in Campion's lecture mentions that as the start of an age of Aquarius. And my first astrology teacher, who I am pretty sure is no longer with us, Helena Runow, she believed that the age of Aquarius started when there was this conjunction of all these planets in Aquarius on February 5th, 1962.
Right.
Now, there was another famous American astrologer named Jean Dixon, who predicted that that was the day that the Antichrist was born.
Right.
My teacher actually believed that that was the day that the Second Coming was born. Now, he would have just celebrated his 55th birthday, if my math is right. And, you know, I guess he decided not to come forward, or she was wrong in her calculations, but she was the one that taught me, bless her heart. I had learned astrology a few years earlier on my own. She was the first person I studied with. She lived in the town. I was Colorado Springs, as a matter of fact. I was living at the time. And I attended her class. And I remember I was like, oh, yeah, I know how to do charts. You know, I don't need to do that part of your class. And I brought in a chart I calculated. And she says, oh, this is like a midnight birth. And I'm like, yeah. And she's like, well, why do you have the sun in the 10th house? And I'm like, dope. Now, this was the days when you had to do like calculations by hand. And I had done a mathematical error, and the sun was in the wrong place. And because I wasn't grounded in the astronomy of astrology, and here's a pitch for learning all you astrologers some astronomy, it didn't strike me as an obvious mistake like it would now or to anyone who works with charts on a regular basis. But yeah, so she definitely humbled me on that. But she definitely was like, the age of Aquarius has started. This spiritual teacher has been born, and he will be coming forward at some point.
Right. So, and that's a point that's really important and worth emphasizing at this point to back up a little bit, which is that it seems like from a very early stage, as far back as Blavatsky, especially in the late 19th century, when this concept of the Age of Aquarius first started gaining currency, that a lot of it had to seem to do more with them, you know, a group of people, of religious people having a specific predefined set of religious beliefs that their religious beliefs were about to manifest in the world, and the world was about to be transformed in this very positive way in the very near future. And then this astrological concept connected with precession became something that they sort of projected those beliefs onto, and that it sort of became a vehicle for promoting those beliefs. And the issue with that is that then as a result of that, the concept of what the sign Aquarius even meant in astrology started to change in order to be closer to what the religious beliefs were that were being projected onto it. So that's one of the issues that you have to sort of wrestle with when you're learning about and when you're trying to analyze this concept objectively to see if there's anything to it, is that every modern astrology book, almost all of our discussions about Aquarius have been influenced by what was originally this religious belief that then kind of got projected onto the sign in order to justify the idea that this age of enlightenment was about to begin.
Right. And I just, for laughs, pulled up the, or not for laughs, but just for clarification, actually, I pulled up the chart for February 5th, 1962. And depending on where you were in the world, on the 4th, 5th, 3rd, 4th, 5th, you had Moon, Jupiter, Venus, the South Node, the Sun. That's right, there was an eclipse at that time. Mercury, Saturn, and Mars all in tropical Aquarius. So astrologically, it was a big deal. I actually haven't met anyone born on that day, but that would be an interesting study.
Yeah, and I mean, the point with that, though, is like that specific thing of a lineup of planets in Aquarius has literally nothing to do with the original concept of astrological ages.
That is correct.
And I think that's a common theme in the 20th century, where sometimes you'll see different astrologers, like Mark Edmund Jones, for example, wrote in one of his books that he thought the age of Aquarius had just begun due to the discovery of Pluto. So it's like Procession was the original idea behind this concept, but one of the issues is that, using Procession, like the beginning of the Age of Aquarius is still a little ways off, or in some calculations, like you said, a long ways off, like a few centuries off.
Right.
If you use like the Lahiri Ayanamsha,
or really any of them, it's hundreds of years off.
Yeah. But it's like, because this was actually not being this wasn't coming from the astrology originally. It was coming from the sort of religious motivation from the Theosophical Society and from eventually the New Age movement. And because there was already this this conviction that, you know, this religious movement was going to take off and it was going to become a worldwide phenomenon, it was like they would look for ways to justify that. And so a lot of the discussion in the astrological community then would sometimes start grasping at straws in order to find different, what looked like major mundane astrological alignments, and then to point at that and say, now, you know, this is the thing that actually indicates that the Age of Aquarius is starting now. So like the discovery of Pluto, or like you said, that lineup of planets in Aquarius in 1962, or, you know, you mentioned the harmonic convergence, which I think it was just a big, like, grand sextile or something that occurred in like 1985 or 1987.
Yeah, I should have been more precise with my dates and time. In fact, I can look that up while we're talking about it. But I just made an astounding discovery.
Oh, did you discover that when the Age of Aquarius is going to begin?
No, but Aquarius let the sun shine in by the fifth dimension. If I let go of... So, okay, we have this famous song in the West... In America by the fifth dimension called Aquarius.
Maybe you should explain it just in case anyone doesn't know or hasn't heard it.
So the fifth dimension was a rock blues band, and a hit they had in, let me just see what year it would have been. Fifth dimension, because I believe it was the early 70s, Age of Aquarius. So we had this hit song and released in 1969. And we really wanted to use it as bumper music for this episode, but, we, due to legal restraints, we can't. But yeah, basically, to get the rights. But the lyrics of the song, and there aren't many lyrics of them, but it starts off with, "When the moon is in the seventh house and Jupiter aligns with Mars, then peace will guide the planets and love will steer the stars. This is the dawning of the Age of Aquarius." Well, February 5th, actually, there was a time on that day where the moon would have been in the seventh house with Jupiter and with Mars in Aquarius. And maybe that's what they were saying. Maybe I'm seeing now that the song kind of makes sense when I look at this February 1962 chart. Although there are many times, the beautiful thing about this song is there are many times when Jupiter is going to be with Mars, you know, every couple of years that happens, and the moon at some point will be in the seventh house from them.
Right. Like every couple of years.
Yeah. Basically. And more than once that year will the moon be in the seventh house. So,
I always interpreted it like symbolically, like they were saying Jupiter aligns with Mars. And so maybe they meant like, war, like peace will happen because the warlike nature of Mars will be quelled by the, you know, peace indicated by Jupiter or something like that.
I don't know. And then having the moon aspecting them, you know, assuming it's a benefic moon. In any event, that's very, very interesting. So anyway, so there's this whole, the notion that we're already in the Age of Aquarius, there is a pop culture phenomenon from the song from 1969 kind of getting into people's minds. So you have like non-astrologers talking about the Age of Aquarius. And of course that was, you know, the Age of Peace and Freedom and protesting the Vietnam War and all that good stuff. But, you know,
right. And then there's periodically, like over the past century, been these periods where somebody tries to pin it on some specific astronomical alignment and says, this is when the Age of Aquarius will begin. And then there's some group that will like have some anticipation in the ramp up to it. And then it'll like come and go. And and nothing will happen, or at least it's not going to be, it's not like a sudden, you know,
right,
dawning of peace and enlightenment for everybody. And there's like disappointment. So it's like, we had a little bit of that with the 2012 thing, which again is just taking something completely unrelated to the original notion of procession and applying it to this other concept of the Age of Aquarius that some people, or sometimes some astrologers, said, you know, in 2012, this is when the Age of Aquarius will begin, because that's what the Mayans said based on, you know, whatever they were basing that on.
Right.
Did you find the harmonic convergence?
Oh, sorry. Dates? I was so distracted by this Age of Aquarius thing. let me go back to the harmonic convergence, which got a lot of press at the time.
Oh, did it?
Because, or at least, you know, in the, I just remember living in Colorado and, you know, people were going places to experience the harmonic convergence. So it was August 16th, 17th, 1987, closely coinciding to an exceptional alignment of planets. Well, let's see what that alignment was. August 16th. Imagine how boring this would be if we had to calculate everything by hand to your listeners. Way back in 1987 and calculate. Yes, please calculate. So what kind of alignment did we have?
August 17th?
Yes, 16th, 17th. I guess it depends on where you were in the world.
Right. I don't even... Jupiter is trying Mars. 3 degrees off. The moon is in Gemini. Oh yeah, it was something to do with like quintiles or something like that. I remember somebody trying to explain it to me once, and I just remember being incredibly unimpressed by whatever they thought they saw in the chart at the time. But again, that just brings me back to, it's like so often the mundane things where astrologers are like, this is a big thing that's coming up. It's like sometimes that'll be relevant, but especially when it gets tied in with like religious beliefs about,
right,
you know, Age of Enlightenment starting at that time or whatever, like it often ends up being not that impressive. And that's one of the reoccurring themes I think I see in like the history of astrology in the past century, at least in the interaction between astrology and the New Age movement.
Oh, and as I'm reading the article here, I'm seeing that there's some Aztec calendar connection and...
No.
There was some people thought it tied into the Mayan calendar. Let's see. Oh, here we go. Sun, moon, and six out of the eight planets being part of a grand trine. So, yeah, I guess I see that.
It's like a very loose grand trine. Where
I go by houses. Okay, I see it. And if I adjust the time a little bit, the moon would get involved. So, yeah.
It's like the, so what is it? Just to read off the positions, it's the, like Mercury is at 21 Leo, Venus is at 22 Leo, Sun at 24, Mars at 26 Leo, and they're sort of widely trine Jupiter at 29 Aries. And then those are all very widely trine Saturn at 14 Sagittarius and Uranus at 22 Sagittarius.
And then depending on when you calculate it, you can get the moon involved.
So it's like, it's not even a close, if that's really it, if it was a grand trine, it's not even a close grand trine. And it's not really clear why that specific day was picked out versus another day, like a few days later or something
like
that.
I guess it eventually got grounded in Mayan calendars and someone's reconstructed Aztec prophecies. Anyway, this was all the hit. It was all kind of like the new thing. And, there were events worldwide, but the aliens didn't come. Mount Olympus didn't take off into space. And some would argue there was a spiritual change. I'm not saying those things don't happen. But we do, as Westerners, we really like this notion of something dramatic is going to happen to change everything for the better at a certain moment. That I've seen over and over again, or fearful that something bad's going to happen, like Y2K.
Well, and that probably goes back, especially in the West, to, you know, the Christian ideas about the apocalypse, and about, you know, more recently, what's the other sort of related thing where everybody gets, all the believers get beamed up to heaven and all the
And of course, there's 1,000 people listening to this right now. The Rapture. Thank you.
Right, The Rapture.
Thank you for sending that telepathically to my brain, future listener. Yeah, The Rapture, where the faithful get zapped up and the rest of us are left behind, as the Left Behind series illustrates.
Right. So, I mean, that's probably part of where that comes from in terms of if you want to like psychoanalyze like the Western psyche or something like that. But so back to this topic, though. So on the one hand, it's like, and it's like Campion's incredibly dismissive of this. And I actually found this really hard, because what's funny is I came into astrology reading, you know, New Age literature starting in 1999, and was super into like this idea that the Age of Aquarius is about to begin. And I remember getting to Kepler and being actually really put off by Nick's lectures on this, because he was not just dismissive of it, but he was also, he was like standing outside of it and showing it how inconsistent it's been over the past century, how many dates have been put forward for it, how it originated with precession, but then astrologers have sort of fallen all over themselves to like point to other things that indicate that the Age of Aquarius is beginning that had nothing to do with the original idea of precession, and so on and so forth. And once you go through that whole process, you realize, you know, the sort of shakiness that a lot of it is built on, or at least how, at the very least, how there's been such a wide variety of different opinions about it, that it's clearly not just this like one thing that everybody's on the same page about once you look into the topic.
And we're, of course, talking about a literal interpretation of a possible, quote, Age of Aquarius, based on these modern concepts, that there is this linkage between the sidereal and tropical zodiac that has some sort of wide, worldwide influence. Now, I think on a personal level, the ideology of an Age of Aquarius, an age where we're more connected, where we're more helping our fellow humanity, and we're rising up to create a better world for everyone. Hell, get on that train today. That personally, I think it's something that you can embrace. You know, take one of these dates that have already happened and say, yes, and I'm going to, you know, start thinking like that and move my life in that direction. And if enough of us do that, then, this actually reminds me of a quote I saw yesterday, although I don't know, who said it, but one of your listeners can probably look that up, but it's just about our own. The quote is, "Few will have the greatness to bend history itself, but each of us can work to change a small portion of events, and in the total of these acts will be written the history of each generation." So we can be the beginning of the Aquarian generation if we want to, if we look at it more symbolically, if we're ready for a more inclusive, you know, humanity worldview. Okay, off the soapbox, back to you, Chris.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you're just talking about very metaphorically and unconnected with any specific technique.
Right.
I mean, which is more just like, you know, let's improve as humanity in general, and not necessarily, doesn't have to be connected with some specific astrological measurement.
Although some people like that. You know, it's meaningful, and it's, I mean, take your pick of what you want to do. But,
And it's like, I'm fine with that. It's that this is often co-opted, like where there's this idea that there's a technique that justifies, you know, my belief that something is about to happen imminently in the near future. And that's where I have problems with it, just because, it's clear that it often doesn't have a lot to do with what the astrology is saying, but instead it has more to do with people projecting things onto the astrology. And I think that's where I have a problem with it sometimes.
Yes, and it is kind of a uniquely Western, you know, it's part of our psyche. You know, a lot of this stuff, even when you read the articles that analyze history through these quote unquote astrological ages, again, a very modern, 20th century idea, it kind of breaks down when you apply it to other cultures and other histories.
Well, and one of the things that's interesting, and maybe you'd be more interested in this, is that from one of the things that's interesting about the premise of the astrological ages and the way that Western astrologers often apply it, which is weird, is that these are typically tropicalists or astrologers who use the tropical zodiac, but they start only within the context of this technique. Even though they don't otherwise use the sidereal zodiac normally themselves, they start applying the tropical meanings, modern Western meanings of the signs of the zodiac that they apply the tropical zodiac. They start applying those to the sidereal signs, even though those positions don't otherwise, you know, correlate with the zodiac that they otherwise usually use. So there's a little bit of a disconnect there for me as well. I know that maybe that's less of an issue, you know, for you or from your vantage point, but I always thought it was weird because...
Well, it's as weird as doing solar returns with, what is it called? Precession corrected.
Right.
I mean... You know, if you're getting, you know, in for a penny, in for a pound, just be tropical all the way with what you're doing. It's when you start mixing it up, it does create weird philosophical questions. And you're right. It is, I mean, is it Western astrology's, well, we want to plug into the star. I mean, I'm not going to psychoanalyze the whole cult Western astrological culture. But I agree with you. It is kind of a strange thing. I mean, there's a lot of ways one may try to unify the two zodiacs or work with both at the same time. But, yeah, this whole kind of ages is weird. I mean, it's a time marker, and we love time markers that indicate something is going to change. And thankfully, we have this kind of 20th century notion of Aquarius being like a great, cool sign.
Right. Well, I mean, maybe that's worth focusing on a little bit. Going back to that point where that was made earlier about how even the meanings of Aquarius were different, were in some instances very different prior to the 20th century. And, you know, that's probably relevant also. I mean, even from an Indian perspective, it's like, I know that some Western interpretations of Aquarius have filtered over, but what, you know, how do Indian astrologers, for example, interpret the sign of Aquarius?
Well, it's a Saturn ruled sign.
Right. So that's actually a super important starting point, is traditionally it's always been a Saturn ruled sign. And in modern Western astrology, it's been a Uranus ruled sign. So right there, you have a much different interpretation just based on that, right?
Yeah. And you have this, you know, because when you think of Uranus as, oh, it's the revolutionary, it's, you know, changing everything, it makes it like, oh, the age of Aquarius, everything is going to be changed. Whereas, you know, Saturn is quite a different, you know, energy. You know, it's a more somber, more practical. The Aquarian does have an association of kind of innovating, but it's not like sudden change Uranus. It's sort of like making real, creating new things from previous things. You know, Saturn is the planet of delimiting things. So in Aquarius as an air sign, it's like, oh, let me think about new ways of delimiting things.
Right. So that idea of Aquarius as a Saturn-ruled fixed air sign, sort of traditionally, both in traditional astrology prior to the 18th and 19th centuries, and then...
Actually, I was looking for my copy of Valens, because I was going to see what Valens... Or actually, wait, let's look at your book. What did the traditional astrologers, how did they describe Aquarius? Because I'm sure it's going to be quite different than what we're thinking of in terms of the age of Aquarius.
Yeah, I mean, when you read it, it's actually kind of funny. I mean, it'll give you a slightly skewed and weird interpretation, but I'll read it really quick. Okay. So in Valens, he says that Aquarius, this is using Riley's translation from page 5. So he says, Aquarius is the celestial sign which is masculine, solid, anthropomorphic, somewhat damp, single. It is mute, quite cold, free, upward trending, feminizing, unchanging base with few offspring, the cause of troubles arising from athletic training, carrying burdens, or work in hard materials, an artisan, public, Men born under this sign are malicious, haters of their own families, incorrigible, self-willed, deceitful, tricky, concealing everything, misanthropic, godless, accusers, betrayers of reputations and of truth, envious, petty, occasionally generous, because of this sign's flow of water.
We are in the age of Aquarius. To my horror, we are in the age of Aquarius.
If we had the music, then this is when the music would start playing right now after reading that.
Oh, man.
And finally, it says uncontrollable is the last signification he gives.
Wow.
So, you know, there's a lot of things that can be drawn from that. But one of the points is just there is this real disconnect between how Aquarius was interpreted. You know, and we could also read like William Lilly's description.
Exactly. Yeah, I was just thinking about that if we wanted to do that. But yeah, very different from the modern notion.
And it's like he's getting a lot of that from Saturn. Like one of the things about concealing everything, that's one of Saturn's significations. If you read his significations of the planets, he says that Saturn, one of its significations, one of its more negative significations, it also has positive ones, but he says one of the things that Saturn can sometimes do is conceal its own deceit. So it can be deceitful, but then it can cover up the fact that it's being deceitful.
Yeah.
So that's where he's getting that from. So that's one of the things you partially have to understand is there's also this change that happened when Uranus was discovered, and then some astrologers started applying Uranus as the ruler of Aquarius. And then it's like that does, you know, to some extent change one's perspective on Aquarius if you take Uranus significations. But then again, there's another issue where sometimes the significations applied to Uranus started coming not from empirical observations and from the astrologers observing what the planet Uranus would correlate with, but sometimes some of the projections, the religious sort of New Age projections onto Aquarius started getting projected onto Uranus as well. So that even, you know, sometimes Uranus is given a much more positive rap than it necessarily always deserves, or sometimes it's idealized a little bit beyond what's necessary without always necessarily acknowledging some of the downsides that can be associated with that planet.
Right.
Astrologically speaking.
Right.
So that's another sort of issue or consideration with this concept. Let's see, where else should we go with this? So, I mean, the Age of Aquarius became synonymous with the New Age and with the New Age movement over the course of the past century. A lot of the big early 20th century astrologers who helped in the revival of Western astrology after it had died out for a couple of centuries, a lot of the early 20th century astrologers like Alan Jones or Alan Leo, Mark Edmund Jones, and Dane Rudyard were all theosophists. So these are all guys that were reading Madame Blavatsky's writings.
Yes.
And were very much like into some of her arguments about the New Age beginning very soon. And so that's part of the reason why this concept got popularized in modern astrology and gained such wide currency. What else? Do you have any other point? Is there anything else we're leaving out or that we're missing? I think we're getting towards the end of our sort of primary points that we wanted to make about this.
Yeah. I think it's just that, as with many of our podcasts, we've hopefully illuminated the history. We've clarified some things. If any listeners really attach to the idea of the Age of Aquarius, again, that's something that personally you can always cultivate in oneself. I think we've just now demonstrated that the traditional understanding of Aquarius, I'm thinking of how communicative our world is now, and Aquarius is listed as mute. I don't know. That doesn't bode well. Like maybe we want the Age of Aquarius to be hundreds of years off. But the thing is, I guess the reason, the thing to remember is it's a fairly modern idea, this notion that there are these periods. And I mean, fairly modern, it's a 20th century idea that like no one really thought of this way in the past. Now, people have thought that there are stages to history and ages, and the Indian tradition has this, as well as the Western tradition with the yugas and Kali Yuga and stuff like that. But it's a much broader cycle than anything that you would tie down to specific astrology.
And in that one, we're like in the middle of a dark age or something, right?
Yeah, we're on, again, depending, there are pundits that calculate it differently. Some would say we're at the bottom of the barrel. Some would say we're crawling back up, but we are in the Kali age, and hopefully we're on the, you know, so you start with like a golden age, you get, it gets worse and worse and worse. Kali Yuga, things get absolutely worse, and then you start going up the second half of Kali Yuga and work your way back up to a golden period. So by most accounts, we are past the worst of it. Although, you know, reading the paper, you might not think that, and we're going up, but we are having Kali Yuga. But good thing, because in the Indian tradition, one of the reasons why we have astrology as a technology is to help us during Kali Yuga. So that's okay. Actually one of the religious beliefs.
Yeah, I mean, and that's one of the New Age beliefs as well, because mm-hmm. just like astrology became a core New Age thing because they thought that, you know, astrology could somehow help in enlightening everybody or helping to sort of raise the
psychic vibrations. I like the idea of Jung's idea of using what we consider the last star of the constellation Aquarius. I mean, if I were to want to mark a particular moment as the quote start of the age of Aquarius, that concept appeals to me because it takes us out of it relates the seasons to an actual star. And I just kind of like that. I mean, it'd be interesting to see when that date actually is. Now, here's the other piece of the puzzle. Stars have become unattached to the vernal first day of spring because the Earth has this weird little wobble. That wobble is not constant. So even if you can calculate on your software the exact moment, that isn't going to be the exact moment because we actually don't know it. We think, and by we, I mean scientists think that the Earth is actually slowing, but sometimes weird things happen I think when that big tsunami hit Japan, we actually like gained a little microsecond or something like that, or it slowed down the Earth a microsecond. I can't remember what, but certain events like affect time. And so it's, you know, you're never going to be able to pin the exact moment, but you could certainly get into the ballpark. And if I were doing this, I think I would use the star of the constellation. That just, I don't know. I like that.
Yeah. I mean, that always seemed sort of like an appealing approach to me as well. And I mean, to whatever extent, and that ties back in something that you said earlier, that if you're doing more of that approach, or even with most of these, if this idea has any astrological validity, which I don't want to completely dismiss that it does, I just wanted to raise a bunch of these issues with it that astrologers don't usually consider, because this has become one of those concepts like Mercury retrograde, where, or like the void of course moon, where it's stated as like this axiom sometimes, or in some sources, without realizing how many different nuances and like different ways of looking at it there are. But if I was to, I do want to like step back on that a little bit and say, to whatever extent, you know, there is anything to the concept, like the idea that, you know, the sign of Aquarius is becoming more prominent, and the way that I conceptualize that sign. I mean, one of the things I do think is interesting that is obviously like a major transition the world is going through is just the computer age and the digital age and the internet age. And there's something about that that is kind of interesting as like a new epoch in human history.
Yes.
That, you know, I could, you know, easily connect with something like, you know, Saturn and Aquarius as an air sign, or even the planet Uranus, if you want to go there in terms of Aquarius, and its connection with sort of electrical or computer type things. But when, you know, there's pros and cons of that. And that doesn't mean that it's like going to be age of enlightenment when, you know, everything is great and you know, fine and dandy permanently from here on out. It's going to be just a new stage in history where you're going to have some pros and you're going to have some cons. So it's like, you know, we're in an age now where suddenly like everyone's connected all over the world through the internet, but then at the same time, sometimes people feel more distant from each other than they ever have been before, because people like communicate through their phone or through Facebook or something instead of meeting in person, or instead of sometimes even calling each other in person.
Right.
So you can have sort of very positive things that you might associate with that on some astrological level, but you can also have downsides. And that seems like a more appropriate approach that we would otherwise take in every other area of astrology, where we would acknowledge both positive potentials and negative potential, rather than just thinking, you know, this is going to be completely good and have no downsides.
Right.
So
yeah, I agree. And so we don't want to rain on anyone's parade because another important point, just because an idea is new doesn't mean it's bad. So while right. we've disabused you of the notion that these astrological ages go back to the beginning of the tradition, that doesn't mean that there may not be something to it. And I mean, I always am hopeful, you know, if things are going to get better, that would be great. You know, obviously, I mean, everyone wants that. But, you know, we all have to do our part in that.
Sure, sure. And yeah, it probably is an interesting and useful way of studying world history and studying, you know, different things related to that. And I have seen different people do interesting work on that. I mean, Rudyard wrote a book that was dedicated towards that topic and had some interesting observations. Rob Hand has an essay on it that's interesting in his book, Essays on Astrology. It's just important to sort of to separate this thing as an astrological technique or concept from the sort of religious notion of the sort of New Age or the New Age movement and some of the things associated with that, so that you can look at the astrology sort of on its own independently, to whatever extent that's yeah. possible.
Yep.
All right. Well, yeah, I think those were a lot of the main points that we wanted to make about this. I'm sure we're forgetting something. I'm thinking, sort of trying to desperately think of what else we're forgetting from what otherwise seemed like a really huge and almost insurmountable topic when we were going to start this.
Right. And I mean, we could have gone into more detail about the Platonic Great Year, but I don't think that's necessary. I'm just kind of flipping through my notes here. But as with all podcasts, 5 minutes after we wrap up, we're going to be like, no!
Right. Yeah.
Or because that's just the like way that. Of things. But, you know, we can always do Age of Aquarius Part 2 if necessary. Part 2. Or put something in the notes. But I think, yeah, I do. I have this nagging feeling there is something we're missing, but I feel we covered a lot of ground.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the next big ones is going to be, you know, there is that Jupiter Saturn conjunction that's going to occur in it's in Aquarius in 2020, right?
Yes. So maybe that will be the start of the Age of Aquarius. Well, maybe there's lots of starts.
Yeah, I mean,
maybe we're like kindling logs in the fire of life, and God has several matches to try to get us going.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, whatever that is. I mean, there's always big. There's not always, but periodically there are big astrological alignments that indicate important turning points in world history. And some astrologers have started to talk about 2020 as being a very interesting year in terms of mundane astrology. I'm still not sure that is connected to or necessarily fully relevant to this other idea connected with the precession of the Age of Aquarius, which I think, you know, largely should be restricted to that specific study Yes. of, you know, precession relative to the sidereal right. zodiac relative to the constellations, but you know, that's probably going to be another one of those ones that people are
unless you want to take
on.
I guess I don't know if anyone someone must have made this argument before, but I guess you could take the discovery, because you said, what was it, Mark Emmon Jones said the discovery of Pluto was yeah. tied. I would say take Uranus, the discovery of Uranus marking the Age of Aquarius.
Yeah, and I think some I'm sure
someone has done that,
right,
and done a chart for the discovery, and then excuse me, choking on water here, and then talked about it, because that would be, you know, if you're going to pick a planet to herald it, I would say, yeah, use Uranus if you're going to tie Uranus to Aquarius, and then we could, if you want to really be weird, you could go back to Galileo's diaries where he accidentally observes Uranus, not realizing that's what it is. And we actually, and that, you know, you could do a chart for that night.
Right. Yeah, I mean, or you could just not associate with the Age of Aquarius and say each of these is a separate sort of event in mundane astrology that has some significance. Yes. But it doesn't, we don't necessarily have to tie it into this overarching and almost has become like this sort of bloated concept of the Age of Aquarius, and instead just look at it more as you would any other thing within the context of mundane astrology, which is that there's always, you know, a bunch of different variables and data points that you can take into account that are all relevant in saying different things about the time frames and world history in which they're occurring. And sometimes just looking at them from that perspective is more useful than trying to sort of attach it to this broader idea of a Age of Aquarius, which has so many, you know, so much baggage, as a result of the way that it's been used or sometimes misused to accomplish certain things or for certain agendas that sometimes it's best to just steer clear of it altogether.
Yep.
But
well said. Well said, sir.
All right. Well, maybe that would be a good stopping point here. Thanks for joining me for this discussion.
Thanks for having me. Listeners, if there are any like East-West topics or debates you'd like Chris and I to do, because his specialty being Hellenistic astrology and me doing Indian astrology, we are ripe for that. We haven't really done too much of that, but if something's of interest to people, suggest it to Chris and we can come back and do that. I actually got a couple of ideas for some future shows just as we were talking today, but I'll go over those with you later, Chris. But thank you so much for having me on again. I love the astrology podcast. Always fun.
Yeah, I always enjoy our discussions. Something I've been thinking about recently actually is, you know, with the release of my book, and one of the points that I make a few times is that some of these old techniques, like recovering time lord systems, which are like the Indian dasha systems, are, you know, they're such a different beast to start working within the context of Western astrology, that some of the ethical guidelines and some of the consulting skills type guidelines that modern Western astrologers have developed in the past 20 years are almost, you know, really not suited to and not designed to be able to deal with something that can do what these techniques attempt to do or what they can do. Mm-hmm. But Indian astrologers or Western astrologers who started practicing Vedic astrology or Indian astrology, especially starting in the late 80s and early 1990s, it's like that community went through a lot of the same issues during that time frame and worked some of this stuff out, right?
Right. Yeah. No. Yes.
Okay. So that's a discussion actually I'd be interested in having pretty soon.
That'd be a great discussion.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's reconvene maybe in the next few months and do a show on that.
Fantastic. I'd love to.
All right, cool. All right, well, I think that's it for this show then. If you enjoy the show, of course, you can always rate it on iTunes. You can subscribe at theastrologypodcast.com/subscribe. And thanks everyone for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Take care, everyone.